I mean, to a monastery, not a dance hall and a massage parlour. Actually, I can't resist saying that the first time I came to the States in 1950, long before most of you were thought of, I was representing British youth along with two others, and we did a tour of the whole States. And when we arrived in Houston, we were taken at once to a square dance. Those were the days. And we were introduced, and I had to make a little speech about Anglo-American relations. This was Korean War time. And so I made my little speech. And after it, the square dance went on. But there was a girl there, about 17, and she stood there with her mouth open, just looking at me. And I said, good afternoon. And she said, oh, you just go on talking. And I said, what would you like me to talk about? Oh, you just talk about anything. I just love your voice. So I hope you're getting used to the accent. Last night I saw Babe. And this actually fits in very... Babe is a film about a pig, for those of you who haven't actually seen it. And this fits in nicely with my development this morning about the joint of the cross. I'm not going to go on about the joint of the cross, but I'd like you to have it constantly throughout the week at the back of your minds, relating it to whatever themes I happen to come up with. Well, my first little story this morning is another sort of Irish fairy tale. There was a New York businessman who had a meeting in Dublin. And at the end of the meeting, he just had enough time to hire a car, drive across Ireland, in order to visit, for the first time, the village where his grandmother was born. And he had a map, and he planned his journey in terms of the time it would take to get there and get back to Dublin in time to catch the aeroplane. All went well on the Irish equivalent of superhighways, going out towards Roscommon and Galway. But then the roads got smaller and smaller, and eventually he found himself in very wild country, going along a very narrow lane. And all was well until he came around a corner, and there in front of him, going in the same direction, was a man walking along the middle of the lane with a stick and a pig. And the pig was wandering around across the road, and the man was walking slowly behind it, and he blew his horn, but no effect, certainly on the pig. And so eventually he pulled in and walked up and said, excuse me, do you mind my asking about your, you and the pig? Ah, sure, that's fine. Well, we're miles from anywhere. Where are you going with the pig? Are you just going for a walk? No, I'm taking the pig to market. Well, I've got a map here. Where's the market? Well, you see that mountain? Yeah, sure. Well, this road goes along, it goes up round the mountain, and then it goes down through a beautiful valley. And it reaches the sea. Ah, it's beautiful there, beautiful. And then the road goes round the headland and round the bay. And on the far side of the bay, there's a market. Well, fine, but it's a long way. But where have you come from? I'm sure I've come from home. Well, I've got this map here. But where's your home? Well, you see that mountain? Yeah, sure, I see the mountain. Well, this road, if you go back there, and there's a little turning just beyond that mountain, it goes up a long, long glen. Ah, there's a lovely loch there, the fishing's wonderful. And then you go along there, past the loch, and there's a gate going up through the heather, and on the top of that's my farm. Well, You mean to say you've come walking with that pig all the way from your farm, over that mountain, down that glen, along this road, and then you're walking all that way across that mountain, round the headland, along the bay to the market town? Yeah, sure. Well, doesn't that take an awful long time? I beg your pardon? Doesn't that take an awful long time? Well, sure it does, but what's time to a pig? There we have a deep culture clash, if you like, sort of between the horizontal and the vertical. But anyhow, two deeply different conceptions of time, how you use it, what it's for. I had a similar experience only a couple of years ago in Chile, where a friend of mine took me for a weekend's fishing, and we hired a Land Rover, and there was a lovely great big, this is in the south of Chile, a big river, and with great extents of green pasture next to it, and we drove through a farmyard, and then we drove along these long extents of green country with the river here, looking for a good place to fish. The banks were quite steep, and we went on and on, and we were both looking at the river and didn't notice that just over the next knoll the grass was still green, but it was a different green because it was a swamp. And we drove straight into the swamp, and the Land Rover went in up to its axles, and we sat there, and my friend said, "Don't worry, I'll get it out." And I thought, well, I'm not joining in that. So I started walking back to the farmyard, several miles, and I got there. Nobody there, except in a little house at the back, I found one woman. And she laughed like anything when I explained what had happened. And then I said, do you have a tractor? And she laughed again. I said, a tractor? You must be joking. The nearest tractor to here is about 60 miles away. So I said, oh. She said, but don't worry. Andres and Paco will be here with the oxen sometime today or tomorrow. And I thought, what did I do? I looked at my watch. Not that that could make any difference at all. As it happens, the oxen arrived within an hour or two, and we walked along at the speed of the oxen to the Land Rover and pulled it out immediately. But as we walked along at the speed of the oxen, I thought to myself, this is the time scale that almost the entire human race has lived by forever. And therefore, people have thought and lived in oxen time. And I thought, my looking at my watch and thinking that I'd got to be back in time to get a fax from Ampleforth about something or other. And again, the culture clash in terms of our attitude to living with time, that the vast majority of our ancestors and a great many of our contemporaries live according to natural rhythms. Let me make it quite clear. I'm not about to say the natural rhythms are good and the artificial rhythms are bad. I'm merely trying to situate the problem that we face. But people have lived according to natural rhythms not just in terms of movement and transport, but in terms of night and day. The arrival of night used to be, and still is for many, a solemn moment which changes the character of our life. We can really cancel the arrival of night with a switch. People used to have to wait for the arrival of travellers, not just for half an hour in Portland Airport, but for weeks at a time in this part of the world, no doubt. I was thinking as I came over from Greenland, and thinking of all the great journeys that took place a century ago to this part of the world, how long they took. And the films that I saw when I was young, the Wild West, and the enormous importance of the railway. You know, there's John Wayne there, and you hear chook, 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 in the distance, a puff of smoke. And then you wait for the train to come. And the Russian novel. I was in Russia not long ago, and we crossed the railway line from Warsaw to Moscow. And in the novels of Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Pasternak, the enormous presence of the railway, which links places hitherto so remote from each other. And so the technology of the last 100 years has gradually made time shrink. We still have to wait for harvest, though most of us don't notice that wait, because we can go into a supermarket and get what we want now. We don't have to sit there wondering whether it's going to rain enough. I know that collectively, a country like this is still subject to enormous natural catastrophes like Hurricane Bertha. But in fact, the man-made rhythms have come more and more to dominate and to some extent to eliminate the weight of the natural rhythms. And it's interesting that in the literature of all times and in the experience of all peoples, one of the most important virtues has always been patience. Because you have to wait for things to happen. Waiting for news, waiting for rain, waiting for travelers, waiting for night, waiting for dawn. As anybody who's had a serious illness and bad insomnia will know, that the waiting and the patience that's required. Whereas nowadays, people don't talk much about patience. What do they talk about? They talk about pressure, because so many things are happening simultaneously, and we have access to so many things in a kind of ever-present now. Whether with the channel switch for a television, or with the internet, or with the fax, or with the telephone, we are immediately available and accessible across distances which no longer matter, and across time differences which no longer matter. And what does this do to the human spirit? And here, if you like, is the problem of the horizontal that I want to think about this morning. Let me repeat, I'm not saying the old rhythms were good and the new rhythms are bad, because we're living through a period of history in which a God-given set of resources that had never been unlocked before has been unlocked. It's not as if God is sitting there saying, "Good Lord, they've discovered nuclear power." It is all given, but how do we react? And how do we interpret the scriptures in this matter? Because if you look at the scriptures, the element of time and the element of waiting and the element of patience are all deeply important. There are some very clear instances where somebody in the scriptures wants what he or she wants now. The Tower of Babel, the people who built the Tower of Babel, wanted power now. David wanted Bathsheba now. He wasn't prepared to wait. He wanted her now. Herodias and Salome wanted the head of John the Baptist now on a dish. And we know the consequences of that desire for immediate gratification. Compare that with Abraham, who waits, who longs for the fulfillment of the promise, can't see how it can possibly be realized, who travels where God calls him to go, is told that his successors will be blessed at some unknown time in the future. By strange coincidence, I had looked at two passages of scripture in connection with this theme, and they both happened to occur in the liturgy this morning. One was a passage about Elijah, and one of the great features of Elijah is that he's always waiting. He's always being sent on journeys. The Lord said to Elijah, "Leave here, go east, and hide in the Wadi Cherith." So he left and did as the Lord had commanded. He went and remained there. Ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening. After some time, the brook ran dry. Then there's the widow of Sarepta. And then the famine in Samaria. And Elijah, the passage that came in this morning's office of readings, Jezebel then sent a messenger to Elijah and said, "May the gods do thus and so to me, if by this time tomorrow," here's Jezebel with her now, "your life, I have not done with your life what was done to each of the prophets of Baal." Elijah fled. He left his servant there and went a day's journey into the desert, until he came to a broom tree and sat beneath it. He prayed for death. "This is enough, O Lord. Take my life, for I am no better than my father's." He fell asleep under the broom tree. An angel touched him and ordered him to get up and eat. He looked, and there at his head was a hearth cake and a jug of water. He ate and drank, lay down again. Angel came back a second time, "Get up and eat, else the journey will be too long for you." And then he ate and drank, and strengthened by that food, he walked 40 days and 40 nights to the mountain of God. And that immediately precedes the story of when Elijah discovers and responds to the presence of God. Not in the earthquake, not in the wind, not in the fire, but in the tiny whispering sound, the still, small voice. And this theme of waiting runs through the whole of the Old Testament and into the New. In Lords this morning, Psalm 42, with that lovely phrase, here in this translation, "hope in God," but in the one we had in church, "wait for God, for I shall again be thanking him." And the Psalms, in all sorts of different ways, emphasize that waiting is an attitude which is necessary if you're going to be able to praise God. if you're not waiting for anything, if you're not, as it were, at the disposal of the passage of time, there is no desire to pray. And I would suggest that one of our problems today is that we are so pressed by time, so pressed by events, so pressed by noise, that of course it becomes extremely difficult to pray. And if we look at the New Testament, we're faced with the astonishing fact that Jesus himself waited for 30 years before doing anything useful. One would have thought that if he'd been to a good careers advice bureau when he was young enough, they would have told him to get on with it. We talk in England, between high school and college and so forth, of gap years. And it's a very good and fashionable thing to take gap years. Jesus took 30 gap years. And we catch one glimpse of him in the temple. And Luke puts in that glimpse in the temple in order to indicate something very special and profound. It's quite easy to think that Jesus, being the Son of God, when he went to the temple, went there really to teach the doctors. Listen, do you know who I am? I know I'm only 12, but I know a thing or two more than you do. But no, Jesus, when their parents found him, was listening and asking them questions. He was using his time. There's a wonderful painting by Durer which shows the scene in the temple with the young Jesus surrounded by a sort of Tower of Babel set of faces, because all the doctors are talking simultaneously at each other, and the face of Jesus is in the middle of them, looking out quietly with his mouth shut and just listening. And it's a very vivid impression it gives of the babble of human words and human noises with the Word of God waiting in the middle. And the Gospel of Luke, if you look at it under the surface, is full of all sorts of waitings expressed by journeys. The journey of the angel of the Nativity. The journey to the hill country of Judea that leads up to the Magnificat. The journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem, the journeying to and from Jerusalem. All these journeys took time and patience. And it's difficult for me, frankly, flying in from Ampleforth, jet lag and all that. It's quite difficult to get back into that concept of the journey and the waiting and the patience. And here we see a very interesting lesson given us by the monastic tradition. Why are you all here rather than on the beach? You could do a lot of the things you're doing here. On the beach, you could have your line dancing and so forth. But you've chosen to come here. And that has quite a lot to do with the impression that you get here about the relationship between human culture and time. I was walking through Hyde Park in London just not long ago, and I saw a nice family group. It could have been one of the family groups here. A couple of children, a man, his wife, relaxed, easy, and suddenly, they were about 20 yards away, suddenly, I thought he'd been bitten by ants or something. The man suddenly jumped into the air and rushed away to the side. And I was just curious about this, but of course, mobile telephone. And he said to his wife, you go on, you know, and he stood under a tree, selling his stocks and shares, whatever it was. And I thought, what an invasion by one dimension of another. There's nothing wrong with a mobile telephone. It's an extremely useful commodity. I was once, when I was a housemaster at Amford, that's in charge of a sort of residential unit, and this was some, 30 years ago. And one morning, I was sitting at my desk when the telephone went. I had one of these old kind of Humphrey Bogart telephones. You know, it stood there and you take a bit off. And the my contact with the world was this telephone and Joe in the porter's lodge. And I could pick up the thing. It had no dial. I could say, Joe, can you put me through to the library? Oh, not now. Maybe in half an hour. Right, thank you. Or can you give me an outside line? There might be one free at about 11 o'clock. Thank you. That was the one link. And this phone went, and I picked it up, and it was the headmaster, the rector, who said, listen, Dominic, I've got a problem, because we're away in the country. He said, I've got some parents coming in. They've chartered a helicopter or something. They're coming in. They've got very little time. And I was going to see them at 11 o'clock, because they might be sending their sons to our school. And I can't see them because the abbot has called a meeting and I've got to be there. Could you look after them for me? And I said, of course. He said, watch out. I get the impression that he's very high-powered and rather pompous and that he's coming up just to find out what these monks are all about. Sure enough, they eventually arrived. But before they arrived, a very strange thing happened. Our electrician, John Atkinson, arrived with two boxes. And I said, good morning, John, what are those? He said, Father, it's the new telephone system. And I said, oh, splendid. And he unwrapped them, and there was a grey phone, modern one, dial and all, and a black one, modern one, dial and all. And so the grey one is for inside, you know, all around the campus, and the black one is for outside. You mean I can dial London? Yeah, sure. So he installed them, and there they all were, the new telephones, and 11 o'clock there arrived Mr. So-and-so from London, and the headmaster had been quite right. The wife was Catholic and very keen for her sons to come to our nice Catholic school. Husband, nothing in particular, and very suspicious of the whole operation. These sort of woolly characters stuck away with the sheep in North Yorkshire. And he proceeded to interrogate me about my knowledge of the city and stocks and shares and career advice and universities and politics and all that. And I was just holding my own when the new grey phone went. So I said, excuse me a moment, please. I picked up the new grey phone, and it was one of my colleagues wanting to check whether the new phone system was working. But he said, hello, Dominic, how are you? I said, and I was just about to sort of chat with him when the new black phone went. So I said, could you hold the line, please? I picked up the new black phone, and it was somebody from outside wanting to check whether the new black phone was working. And we were just getting into that conversation when, lo and behold, the old telephone. So I said, could you hold the line, please? And I picked up the old telephone, and this was a perfectly genuine call, and I dealt with it, and then I dealt with the second one, then I dealt with the first one. And when I turned back, it was obvious that my big executive was a two-telephone man. And he was completely won over by this image of the high-powered managerial monk sort of running the world through all these different channels. And from then on, I had no trouble with him at all. The moral of the story, of course, is that both by temperament and as a monk, in my heart of hearts, I'm either a no-telephone man or a very limited one-telephone man. Because we're trained by our Benedictine tradition to have a very particular kind of attitude to communication. We're told to listen, and we're told to listen in different ways to different parts of our life at different times in a disciplined way. And the whole of monastic tradition, not only in terms of telephones, but in terms of many other things, expresses this. It would be inconceivable, at least I hope it would be, even in Mount Angel, be inconceivable suddenly for Father Polycarp to have his mobile telephone go off in the middle of Mass. Although I have actually been in church where a priest placed his mobile telephone on the altar next to the bread and wine. But anyhow, either in church or in the refectory, because there are conventual duties which are devoted to another level of communication. Listen, my son, to the voice of the Master. And that voice comes partly through the abbot, partly through the timetable, partly through the sick, strangers, guests, the young, the old. One's supposed to be listening at different times and in different spaces, physical spaces, to the different calls that come indirectly through God. Let us look very carefully at what's happened to the family meal. Even the very best of families are sitting there having their Sunday lunch when suddenly, and Mum gets up and disappears the rest of the meal. Because it may be a daughter or something, but it's as if anybody can walk into the living room and the dining room of any house and say, could you please come outside at once for 10 minutes? I don't care if you're in the middle of your meat course, but what is happening to the family meal? What is happening to these ordered institutions in which monasteries used quite simply to be echoing what is perfectly normal, or was perfectly normal, in the family? We call a monastic community the family, the familiar. And many of its customs are deeply rooted in family customs. Very interesting thing about the about a monastic building. I was looking at this building in relation to this particular thought. I used to think that monasteries were wonderfully sophisticated things thought up by brilliant architects down the ages. Whereas in fact, I discovered from moving around the Mediterranean world that a monastery is really based on a Roman farm, where it's built in a sort of quadrangle sort of way for reasons of light and heat. And so you've got a central space which is protected and a covered way where you can walk without getting either hot or wet. And from that, there grows the idea of the monastery cloister. Here, it's been reproduced in a very skillful way, partly in a sort of dialogue with traditional American architecture and Romanesque and so forth, where you've got the very open quadrangles, but buildings related to each other in a very particular way. And the traditional monastic cloister is a place where it's very easy to get lost. Because I'm talking about the traditional cloister with four sides to it and a covered way. And you walk into it, and you don't know where you are. There's a door here, and there's a door behind you, there's another door at the end there, and there are two more doors along there. And you're looking, let us say, for the church. And you don't know which of these doors goes to it. And you're a passing monk. You say, excuse me, Father, where's the church? And you say, just down there, turn right, and then you find two doors, one's the church, one's the sacristy. And if you stay there any longer, you'll find church, sacristy, library, refectory, kitchens, workshops, garden, and all the doors are sort of equal. And they indicate a statement that St. Benedict makes very, very clearly, that all these activities are equal before God. It's not prayer and the rest. No. Prayer has its status. But before God, its status is much the same in terms of human culture as the refectory or the library or the workshops. And you go from one to the other at the call of the bell in an ideal world. And in each of them, you are responding to different calls from God, which come through the different spaces at the different times. St. Benedict talks an enormous amount about time. You know, at when the Alleluia should be said, and which psalms should be said at which particular moment, different seasons of the year, times for recreation, times for work, times for rest, variations according to the time of year. And it is a way of interpreting God's message to us through the creation of time, which is aiming at a very careful set of balances in which all time is there to be used, celebrated as a gift, never simply managed as a commodity in order to fit in as much as possible in a given time. This is a profoundly humane thing, and over the generations it has expressed itself in the buildings. The very fact of stepping into a monastery gives one a curious sense of ordered peace, because the buildings speak of this. St. Benedict went away into the desert to live in a cave and ended up, because of his particular cultural tradition and the pressure put on him by his disciples, ended up by creating first the European city with its carefully modulated spaces around the central space of the oratory, but all with equal status. And when he says to the cellarer, to the bursar, to the procurator, to the administrator, you must make sure that all the tools of the monastery, that which means the cars, the computers, the faxes, the rakes, the shovels, the buckets, the lot, these all should be treated like the sacred vessels of the altar. And what is said about the tools is equally implied about all the other activities. And amongst those activities, clearly the telephone, the fax, the internet, the cars, all these have their function. But there is a particularly eloquent message in the monastic organization of time, which perhaps is becoming of increasing importance to our own rather battered culture. When we hear the readings, when we sing the psalms, we're taking quite a lot of time to do what could be done much more quickly. If you're a monk, you notice very much the difference between the time spent in church, in choir, celebrating Lords, and the time spent if you're saying it by yourself. I thought this morning when I got up over in the guest house, now if I do matins and Lords by myself, I can get that done in no time at all. But if I quietly do the office of readings for myself and then go to Lord's, that's going to take, in terms of getting there, being there, waiting to start, That's going to take the best part of an hour. But the, and here again, monastic music, which has become so fashionable in Los Angeles traffic jams on disc. Why? Because monastic music is in fact a very beautiful and elegant way of wasting time. if you see what I mean. monastic music, with its deliberate avoidance of, you know, beat and hurry and noise, it opens out spaces and creates a sense of leisure or leisure, whatever you like to call it, in the way that you use words, and as I was indicating earlier, it makes possible the experience of praise. There's a great deal of talk about religion nowadays, as if it were mainly about morality and behavior and being nice to immigrants or whatever it might be. Whereas in fact, the heart of the religious experience has always been praise. And if you're going to praise, you need to plan it. It's part of a human culture. Like just beforehand, going through that rather lugubrious thing about perceiving the glory of the Father. I'm sure it'll come out lovely in the end. But it's the planning and the music and the incorporation of human culture which has produced monastic architecture, monastic chant in its various forms, and that strange monastic sense which one gets if you're a monk. You get as soon as you walk into a Benedictine monastery, you feel, no matter where it is, one feels at home, because you feel that the particular monk walks and talks in a way that expresses a particular sense of time and of the way that time is actually lived in the monastery. Right, I've said quite enough to indicate what the nature of our problem here is. I repeat a third time, I'm not saying that the natural rhythm, you know, a kind of peasant rhythm with oxen and no cars and the rest of it is better than the other one. That would be a profoundly retrograde and uncivilized thing to say. What we're talking about here is exactly the same as what Elijah was dealing with in the Old Testament and what Christ was dealing with in the New Testament, the problem of idolatry. Here we're up against a problem of idolatry. The man in the park whom I saw was tempted to idolize his mobile phone and make it more important than his wife and children. And we see that phenomenon all around us, and we see it breaking up families, and we see it causing great strain and unhappiness. People can idolize modern technology. The biggest simple example is the car. Think of the idolatry of the car over practically the whole of this century. Well, now, a similar sort of idolatry can operate with the email, with the internet. One can see people getting so absorbed that it eliminates the possibility of balance. My question is, how do we best convey to our contemporaries that sense of balance between times and spaces which is an essential part of human culture, no matter what tools you're using. I've been deeply impressed, but I mean, I'm not a sort of computer man and an internet man at all. I'm just too ignorant and old. But I've been very impressed by monks I know who are into it and who know how to use it and who know how to use it in a balanced way for the benefit of their monastic work and of their community. It would be absurd to suggest that a modern monastery could function without a telephone or without computerization of management. It would be absurd. But how do we convey that the wonderful feeling of the scriptures in these particular respects? There is an appointed time for everything. There is a time for every affair under the heavens, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to uproot the plant, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to tear down, a time to build, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones, a time to gather them, a time to embrace, and a time to be far from embraces, a time to seek, and a time to lose, a time to keep, and a time to cast away, a time to be silent, and a time to speak, a time to love, and a time to hate, a time of war, and a time of peace. That culture, that attitude, is just as applicable to our own urban culture as it is to the rural. We need to do a lot of thinking about it, and I'm not giving answers. We haven't got there yet in this area, as we haven't got there yet in the area of the use of nuclear power or in the knowledge of genetics. We haven't got there yet, and we're faced, as always in these sophisticated areas, and never more so than in your own culture, with the two extreme reactions of the progressive scientist who thinks that all the problems are solved, and of the backward-looking fundamentalist who thinks that the problems should be eliminated. We stand, on the whole, in the middle, between those two extremes, trying hard to think well, to pray well, to work together well, and to love our contemporary world well enough to think that it's worth helping them work out an approach towards the problem. And the monastic presence in doing that will always be a quiet one. Most monks are rather retiring people. They know that they're not frontline missionaries. They know that they've been asked to do fairly small jobs in a fairly small place. But we're living in a time when those small jobs and the small places and the attitudes that arise from that experience combined with prayer are becoming very important. A monastery is a place where things have time for gestation and needn't be done in a hurry. And I leave you with the lovely remark of Jesus himself, who was fascinated by the passage of time, in particular fascinated by the vision of and the experience of growth. It takes 9 months for anything important to happen, and sometimes more. Look, the kingdom of God, it's like a man who scatters seed on the land, and he sleeps, and he rises night and day, and the seed goes on growing. He doesn't know how. Of its own accord, the land yields the fruit. First, the blade, then the ear, then the full grain. And the harvest has come. And Jesus continually encourages us to think of our lives in terms of a harvest for which we have to wait. But in doing so, he also urges us to bring forth from our treasury both old things and new. So I hope that helps us a little to think about the burden of the horizontal that we all carry in this particular context of our experience of time and the way it works, and help us not only to cultivate pressure but also patience.